The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, I'm Rabbi Rami, and this is the Spirituality and Health podcast. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today, Chip Conley, is a best-selling author, hospitality entrepreneur, and former head of hospitality and strategy at Airbnb. He recently served on the boards of the Burning Man Project and the Esalen Institute, and he's the author of Peak and the New York Times bestseller Emotional Equations. He currently heads the Modern Elder Academy, and his new book is Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. Chip is the subject of the cover story of the May-June issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Chip Conley, welcome to the Spirituality and Health podcast.
Thank you, Rabbi Rami.
So, you know, I want to talk to you about Wisdom at Work. I know you have a new book coming out in January. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about that. That one, Wisdom at Work, is about the making of a modern elder. I understand that your new book is talking about midlife.
Yeah. Learning to Love Midlife. And the subtitle is 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age. And it's really chronicles my last 5 years, 6 years actually, of creating a place called the Modern Elder Academy and working with, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 alumni around the topic of how do you navigate midlife? And shouldn't there be rites of passage and rituals in one's 40s, 50s, and 60s, and frankly, throughout all of our life. But yeah, it's been quite an endeavor. And I learned a whole lot about the Rodney Dangerfield of life stages, midlife. Don't get no respect.
No respect. So, you know, we'll talk about it when the book comes out, if we get a chance. But is it a prequel to Wisdom at Work or a sequel to Wisdom at Work?
Good question. It is. It's funny because Wisdom at Work, the Making of a Modern Elder, was my experience at Airbnb, where they called me the Modern Elder in my first couple of months there because I was twice the age of the average employee. And then I said, I don't want to be a Modern Elder. That sounds like I'm elderly. And they said, no, elder and elderly are two different things. A Modern Elder is someone who's as curious as they are wise. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, wow, that's what I want to be when I grow up. So yes, I'll be your Modern Elder. The Learning of Midlife is really a sequel to it. Even though from an age perspective, midlife sounds like it happens before elderhood, but elderhood could happen, frankly, at any age. You know, if you're a football player in the NFL at 35, you're an elder. So yeah, it's sort of the Wisdom at Work is more my experience of what it was like to be a boomer in the land of millennials.
Yeah, I did a little research on the demographics of Airbnb and the average age, what I found, who knows if this is accurate, because I got it from, you know, Google, but they said the average age is between 20 and 30. So yeah, that's a very young
26 was workforce. The average age when I was there. It's probably crept up to 28 at this point, but I was 52 when I joined. So I was twice the age of the average person.
Yeah. Okay. But I want to take a step to the side for a second. We'll get to the making of a modern elder in a few minutes. But I really want to talk to you about your sense of Burning Man and Esalen, because you were recently serving on the boards of both. And I've had experience with neither. So I want to get your sense of them.
Sure.
Especially how these two phenomena, Burning Man and Esalen, reflect and impact American spirituality. So let me flesh this out for you so you know where I'm coming from and see if the question makes any sense to you. I mean, Esalen's been around since 1962. Mm-hmm. And in its own mission statement, it sees itself as a, quote, creative laboratory, an incubator of human potential, asking the daring and curious questions that traditional university and religious institutions can't and or won't. So let's just deal with that for a second. I don't know about, you know, universities. I taught for 10 years at a university. I don't know what questions they were supposed to ask or didn't, but I live and breathe in religious institutions. And I'm curious as to what you think the questions they can't ask or won't ask might be.
That's a provocative mission statement from Esalen. Wait till you see Burning Man's mission statement. It's probably even more so. I would say that Esalen has always imagined that the boundaries of human potential have been constrained by cultural influences. And, you know, today that might mean boundaries around gender or race. But in the past, it might be boundaries around, you know, well, it definitely was in the 1960s and 70s around psychedelics, which has interestingly made a comeback. But I think for many people, the reason that they liked Esalen, and it was there's a book called The Religion of No Religion that defined Esalen, was there was no specific set of dogma. It was really more the poo-poo platter of modern spirituality served up in a way that felt, you know, quite transformative on the Big Sur coast of California. And so the kinds of questions that might come up would be questions about, you know, patriarchy or about, you know, how do we consider, you know, I was at an Esalen workshop 30 years ago talking about artificial intelligence. It's become a hot topic, but 30 years ago, it was sort of not a topic that was actually considered much. So Esalen has something called CTR, the Center for Theory and Research, which actually does deep dive confabs of leaders around the world, thought leaders on particular topics. They're usually 20 years ahead of the rest of the world. So it's that's how it's been constituted. It's very fortunate. It has some of the best real estate in the world and hot springs overlooking the coast and amazing food. So it's quite an experience.
You know, if someone asked me, what are some of the questions that religious institutions can or won't ask? It seems to me that it's not that they won't ask the questions. They're not afraid to ask them. They're afraid to answer them. Mm. Because the questions that religions ask are the right questions, in a sense. What's the nature of life? What's the nature of reality? What's the nature of the human being? But they're afraid to answer them in a way that violates the theology they inherit. And that's where the patriarchy comes in. That's where the dualism comes in. That's where
the dogma, you know,
the dogma comes in, right? So I think that and there's lots of places like this, but I think maybe Esalen was the first. That where Esalen comes in is it challenges the answers in such a way, not just an academic way or a theoretical way, but in an experiential way, that it allows you to taste something as opposed to really answer the question, but to taste an answer that we have yet to be able to articulate. But you know from that taste that whatever answer you've been given so far isn't it. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it does sound right. I think that Esalen, when I first went there 40 years ago, was a place where they were talking about success scripts. So this is the 1980s, and it was sort of blasphemous on some level for someone who is in the corporate world to say, you know, am I on a treadmill that is not serving me? And, you know, I think the 1960s and 70s certainly had people go to the other extreme. But in the 1980s, asking questions about how we have been programmed in our minds to operate from a place of fear as opposed to a place from love is sort of deeply woven into the Esalen fabric. And I, if there is a dogma for Esalen, it is definitely that love is the universal code of spirituality. And that, you know, that's been what Esalen's been about for, you know, all these years.
And I think there's some who would say, well, religion has the same code, but I think really that's not true. That I think if you go into it carefully with your eyes wide open, fear is the primary code that religion works with. At least Western religion.
Yeah. Richard Rohr and I have talked about this a bit. Richard is a student. He came to the Modern Elder Academy campus in Baja as a student, amazingly, for Lynn Twist's Soul of Money workshop. And because we are growing into Santa Fe, New Mexico as our next location after Baja with the Modern Elder Academy, he's become a good friend because he's based in New Mexico. And one of the things he says is that, you know, institutions, all of them, but let's focus on religions right now, there's sort of a, there's a there's a process where they have an inspired leader or an inspired, an inspired leader, someone who was the missionary who gets the message out. And then they start to build, you know, the structure around that. And in building the structure around it is when the fear starts to be fomented, because there's an element of they have to feed the machine. And so, you know, whether it's modern religions or any something else, you get to a place where systems and processes take precedence. And at that point, some of the freedom of thinking and the ability to see love as the connective tissue of humanity gets lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what happens to, I guess, like you're saying, with all institutions. I mean, that's the challenge, I guess, is to keep, if you can speak of an institution having a heart, to keep the heart of an institution open. So let me ask you about Burning Man, and then we're going to go to the book. So like you said, the mission statement of Burning Man. So here's a bit of that. Mission statement there says, quote, "We believe that the experience of Burning Man can produce positive spiritual change in the world." So that's nothing small about that. But when I read it, I thought of this historian, Molly Worthen. Mm. And she talks about emerging American spirituality. And she says, it's not so much about positive spiritual change in the world, but about personal optimization. And that contemporary American spirituality is highly individualized. Mm. And it's about improved sleep, better health, personal tranquility, and successful entrepreneurship. It's like instead of, you know, trying to make it to Nirvana, you're trying to make it on Shark Tank or something. No, that's me. She doesn't say that. You know, I'm just putting it that way. And I'm wondering, you know, if your sense, you know, I mean, you're in the business world, you're with Airbnb, but you have also this deep spiritual connection. If your sense is that business or maybe capitalism itself is the wrong place to try to work out world-changing spirituality.
Yeah, let me unpack some of that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call Burning Man capitalism, but I would say that are there a lot of capitalists who go to Burning Man? Absolutely. And that's one of the challenges of Burning Man is that sort of the caste society of what are called the plug-and-play camps where wealthy people come in and they don't do any of the kinds of giving that's done. So it's a giving economy. Let's start by that, saying, you know, yes, you pay to get into Burning Man, but once you're in Burning Man, the only thing that costs you any money is coffee and ice. So it's a gift economy where people actually walk from camp to camp and they have a meal or drinks or things like that because everybody's just sharing things. It's, you know, unique in that way. I would say that one other thought about Burning Man is that Emile Durkheim studied, French sociologist, studied religious pilgrimages back in around 1910. And he coined a phrase, collective effervescence. And in coining that phrase, he was really speaking to the idea that when people are in a mission-aligned group of others and they feel a deep sense of connection, their sense of ego separation starts to melt. And what emerges in its place is communal joy. That is what I've seen at Burning Man. I've seen it at the Modern Elder Academy. I've seen it in places where it's not a capital. It's not about personal optimization. Yes, people do go to Burning Man to have ultimate high and take psychedelics and get laid. That does exist. I'm not here to say that doesn't. But I will say that I think the part that is beautiful around Burning Man is the utopian society, the element of how, as Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb, once said when he first was there, this is like how the world would be if artists ruled the world. And I think there's something to that. And there's a utopian spirit to the place. And yet there are a lot of capitalists there. And a lot of capitalists go there to blow their mind, get creative, and maybe make some contacts along the way. And that's where I can see Molly's quote being relevant, because it's, you know, if Burning Man has become a networking event, God help Burning Man, because that's, you don't go to Burning Man to have a schedule. One of the 10 principles of Burning Man is immediacy. Immediacy means when someone says to you, how about when I am at Burning Man next week, let's meet at noon at the Man on Tuesday, that if someone ever said that to you, the first thing to say to them is absolutely not. Because the reason you go to Burning Man is because you want to have epiphany have her way with you. You want serendipity to rule the day. And that means you don't have calendared events and you don't try to network. You actually just you see who shows up in your life there, and you see what kind of how your mirror neurons can play with each other or dance with each other.
Well, I mean, that the way you describe it, I feel like I've missed out by not going, and now I can't afford the ice. And I don't drink coffee, so I don't know. Maybe I should go anyway. No, it sounds really fascinating. It's something that I think it's definitely worth probably experiencing at least once. Do you still go every year?
You know, back in the day, I went pretty much every year for maybe almost 20 years. And so, I'd say I went 13 of 20 years in a row. I have not gone for the last 5 years. Part of that's been COVID. Part of that's been, just busy. And part of it is an element for me of feeling, I love Burning Man, but as Henry David Thoreau once said, the cost of something is measured by how much life you have to give for it. Burning Man is a big commitment. It's far away. It's a pilgrimage. You have to get prepared for it. You have to get, once you come home, you have to clean up, because it's a bit of a mess, all this dust everywhere. And so in some ways I've come to a place in my life where I have recognized that I've loved my experiences at Burning Man. And I don't want to say I've outgrown Burning Man, because I don't think anybody can. I think what I have done is I have gotten clear that there's other things I want to spend my time doing. And, I've over-invested in my Burning Man relationship and maybe under-invested in some other areas.
Okay. Well, I can appreciate that. At this point in my life in my 70s, when I think of Burning Man, I immediately think of Preparation H. So maybe I'm too old for the whole thing. So let's leave Esalen, let's leave Burning Man, let's go to Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, your most recent book. And I'm going to take a different tack with this book, because there were so many interesting facets to it. So hopefully this isn't just going to be the kind of interview you've done 100 times. And I want to pick up on something that you write early on in the book. And I'm going to quote you back to yourself. And you say, "Yesterday, I woke up with a 57-year-old man in my bed. And more painfully, he showed up looking back at me in my bathroom mirror. I may feel 17, but catching a glimpse of my badly lit 57-year-old image is awful tasting truth serum." So, I get what you're saying, right? You feel 17, but you're actually 57. Now, today, you're in your early 60s. So, do you feel 19? Do you feel 21? I really want to explore this, because I don't get what it means. And I'm just a couple of days away from finishing my 72nd year. Yeah. I don't get what it means to feel 17 or 21 or even 62. What are you thinking of?
Yeah, and I am 62. I would say, it's interesting. 5 years later or 6 years later, as I hear that, I probably wouldn't write that again, because what it's glorifying is the idea that youth is what we all aspire to. And I've become more and more of the belief that aging can be aspirational. Social scientists have shown the U-curve of happiness. And what their research has shown across all cultures around the world is that we have a long, slow decline in life satisfaction from our early 20s to around 45 to 50. And then we bottom out. And then with each passing decade after age 50, we feel better and better. Our life satisfaction continues to grow with every single decade. So it's like a big smiling you. And what that suggests is that I think as we get older, if we're smart, we stop playing on the playing field of youth, which is our body, our looks in our body. And yes, it could be our energy. I have a lot of energy, that's for sure. But the truth is that as we get older, the playing field of the body can be replaced by the playing field of the heart, our emotional intelligence, our relationships. the playing field of spiritual curiosity, because, you know, as Richard Rohr says, you know, the first half of our life, our primary operating systems are ego. And the second half of our adult life, it's our soul. But nobody gave us a warning or operating instructions for this new operating system that we've installed around age 50. And, you know, there's wisdom and there's actually brain function that actually gets better with age. So I guess I would just say, today I probably wouldn't make the connection of like saying, you know, I'm 57, you know, as I was when I wrote that, and I feel 17 and I'm lamenting what I look like in the mirror. I'm more of a believer that, you know, the more comfortable I got in my own skin, the more it started to sag. So I don't mind the sagging. I don't mind not trying to look like I used to. Now for women, this is a harder one because, you know, Modern Elder Academy is a pro-aging product. But most products out there in the world, there's an anti-aging industrial complex. And most anti-aging products are really anti-women products because they're oriented toward helping women feel better about their physical looks as they age. And I think that's a really important thing for us to remember is that, you know, there's a lot of ageism associated with getting old, a lot of sexism that's associated with getting older. There's also ageism. And for women, they often are in a situation where they feel invisible and the way that they had currency in the past, they no longer have. Now, men have their issues too. And this is really more the topic of my next book, Learning to Love Midlife. For women, it's invisibility. For men, it's irrelevance. Those are the two most fomenting thoughts and that people struggle with often in their midlife. But if women can realize they don't have to be judged on their looks as much as they used to, and if men can realize there's other ways to be relevant, and then all of a sudden we have solved.
So I think those are really important points. I'm glad you raised those. But I want to get back to the bathroom mirror, because here's my issue. This is just personal. You know, I'm talking to you instead of going to therapy. So I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror, I don't even know who that guy is. Right? Not because I identify with me at 35. I don't know who that guy was. It seems like the older I get, I don't seem to be anybody in particular. You know, I mean, there's a brand. There's Rabbi Rami, who's got 36 books and who has a podcast and, you know, contributing editor to Spirituality and Health magazine. Has got all these things. But when I look at the guy looking back at me in the mirror, it doesn't seem to be that guy. When I try to think, okay, I'm finishing my 72nd year of life, that doesn't feel like anything in particular. It doesn't have any resonance with me whatsoever. It seems, and I'm going to ask if you feel the same way as you're getting into your deeper into your 60s, it seems to me the older I get, now this sounds dumb now that I'm hearing it in my head, but the older I get, the less I seem to be anybody at all.
Yeah, beautiful.
Does that make sense to you? Okay, so what am I saying, or should I you know, get myself committed?
No, you shouldn't get yourself committed. But it in some ways, you know, I'm sure your primary operating system changed way before you were in your midlife because of the profession that you're in and the writing that you've done. But, you know, being able to be less objectified about our body as somehow defining who we are is an incredibly liberating experience, because it's more like this is the Uber. My body is the Uber that I'm taking, that is the delivery vehicle for my soul. And so, yeah, this, just like a car as it ages, doesn't look as good as it did, was fresh off the assembly line. The fact is that, you know, a great leather sofa that has a patina over time only gets better with age. And so, you know, we are each our own versions of a sofa. It doesn't mean you don't have, you know, you're not long in the tooth. You are going to be long in the tooth. You're not going to look as good as you did, but I think being able to disconnect our sense of who we are from who we look like, and instead ask ourselves, how does life feel for us? How does it look? That is a huge liberation.
So how does it feel for you? Can you articulate that?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I define wisdom as metabolized experience, which leads to distilled compassion. And I believe that as I've gotten older, I've been able to see the pattern recognition in my life, the metabolizing of experience, to see, okay, I am playing out that role again. I felt it today. I felt badly today. So how does it feel? Today it felt badly because I could see at age 62, like, Chip, you're just like, you're trying to be the hero again. That's your archetype, Chip. You're trying to be the hero. Step away from being the hero and step away from being the anxious achiever. Step away from some of these roles that you have inhabited because you can see where they go. So I won't say that it feels so. Today has been a tough day because I have been able to notice my patterns. And, you know, Carl Jung famously said, you know, it's when you make unconscious conscious, you know, fate becomes destiny, and you really have the ability to curate your life moving forward because you're not being influenced by the shadow self that is, you know, lurking underneath the surface, but, you know, beneath your vision. And so I think as we get older, that shadow self becomes more evident. And for some people, that's really hard and they just drink more or they work harder or they look for a younger version of their spouse. And for others, it's depressing because it's like, oh, wow, what got me here is not going to get me there. And so I think that's why, you know, MEA exists. I lost 5 friends to suicide in midlife during the Great Recession. And part of the reason I created the Modern Elder Academy was to help people reimagine and repurpose themselves in a cohort of people who are similarly in the midst of navigating their midlife transitions. And I think it's just desperately unfortunate that as a culture, we have rites of passage for bat mitzvahs, bar mitzvahs, communions, you know, graduation ceremonies, weddings, baby showers. But between baby shower and death and your funeral, there's really nada, there's nothing. And part of the reason MEA exists is to help create some rites of passage and rituals for people along their middle passage.
Yeah, that kind of rite of passage is absolutely necessary. And I would take a couple of minutes to ask you more about that, but I'm not going to at the moment because I want to go back and ask you, who told you, Chip, step away from being the hero? You know, what part of you was that? What I heard was there's a part of you that isn't identified. This is what I heard because I'm projecting. When I said to you a moment ago that the older I get, the less I seem to be anybody at all. So what I heard is the person who isn't anybody at all said to you, who's the real Chip, right? Said, step back from being the hero, step back from doing what you're doing, because that's not who you are. Who you are is the undefinable, you know, I don't know. I mean, you used the word soul a couple of times. Maybe you want to call it that. I don't know. But it's something that isn't labelable, isn't definable. And that something is speaking, and this is a question, is that something undefinable speaking more loudly to you, trying to, I mean, it's almost trifurcated. There's the you that is undefinable speaking to the you that is putting on all these personae like the hero and telling you to stop doing that. But really what you need to do is to be that undefinable you, which you already are. Is that? Yeah. Okay.
I think there's accuracy to that. I think that, you know, the idea that, as we've had enough patterns to recognize in our life, we can see that we can interrupt those patterns. So who is actually saying that? I would say it is that soul part of me. And that soul part of me actually is when it's saying it in my 50s or my 60s, wow, if I'm not listening to it, it really is hurting because in some ways it is disavowing something that used to be undercover. But this is now, the soul becomes like a whack-a-mole at the carnival. It starts to pop up and pop up and pop up. And if you're not willing to actually listen to it, you better distract yourself with alcohol or sex or all kinds of other things, because that soul is going to keep coming back. And frankly, I think a lot of the circumstances we often have in midlife are tragic and difficult, partly to actually force our attention on that soul.
Could you say that maybe Burning Man started out as a way to listen to the soul, but now it's become a way to distract?
I think it depends on the person. I think for many people, Burning Man people say, I have to go back to the default world when the Burning Man's ending. And the default world is you just sort of default to what's expected of you. So I think Burning Man still is very much a place where people go to listen to their soul. At the same time, there are a lot of people who go to Burning Man because it's a spectacle. And they want to mainline the collective effervescence, that ideal of communal joy.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's sort of like taking a pill, and that's what they're looking for. And, you know, that it's just like anything else. If all you're doing is trying to have the short-term benefit without doing the short-term, the long-term practice, you know, that's not going to last for very long.
Yeah. So let me just, I've got two more questions, because I notice we're already over the time limit.
Yeah, but
if you can just give me a couple minutes.
Sure.
So you mentioned ritual, and it's so important, these rites of passage that we don't have, that you're trying to help create in your modern elder workshops. Give us a sense of why ritual is important and the kind of things that you see emerging in the programs that you're running.
Well, ritual is important because of a couple things, many things, but I'll point out two. One is, a ritual or a rite of passage gives you a before and an after. It's a distinct line in the sand of saying, this is a new time. And, you know, when people are going through transitions, they often need that, because otherwise, you know, they don't really know, are they in this new era in their life? So ritual helps to define that. And when it's in a rite of passage format, where you're doing it in a community, it provides that social support. There's reasons why rites of passage exist around major transition times in people's lives. And it's partly because the community is coming out in support of the people going through that. So I think those two things are really important. And we weave it into our MEA experience. Within the first 24 hours, people do something called the Great Midlife Edit, because one of the first things we believe people need to do is they need to actually let go of and shed the identities, the mindsets, the habits that aren't serving them anymore. And we go through a whole process to help people get to those. But when we do that collectively, you know, and throw pieces of paper in the fire of what we're letting go of while we're watching the sunset over the ocean, that's an experience that you're going to remember the rest of your life. And you're doing it with a collection of 20 or 24 or 28 other people. And those are people over the course of a week who are going to become deeply close to you.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that is so needed, the ritual creation like that. Okay. So last question, you have this African proverb in the book that I just loved. It's near the end of the book. And it says, when an elder dies, it's like a library has burned down. Mm-hmm. And we live in a time, especially in the United States, when we're metaphorically trying to burn down libraries by banning books.
Yeah.
And the idea is, you know, you cite Jared Diamond's notion that the way a society treats its elders speaks to their perceived usefulness. And we don't put our elders on an iceberg and send them off, you know, adrift in the ocean, maybe because we're running out of icebergs. But we do put them in elder communities where we, you know, can just leave them alone and erase any guilt we have, because we know that we imagine they're being well taken care of. But I like this idea of a library, and I like it for two reasons. One, because libraries are becoming more rare, I think, in our civilization. We don't value them the way we used to. We don't value books the way we used to. And maybe I'm just old, and in you know, completely digital world, libraries and books are just, oh man, you're just too old for this age, and you know, forget that. But I like the metaphor. I think it's really important. So my question is this: to what extent in today's world are elders still libraries, and to what extent do you think society is going to continue to value that aspect of elderhood, that library nature of the elder?
So a traditional elder is the library, I would say, and it's all the history, all of the past. And generally speaking, kids these days don't go to grandpa or grandma for wisdom. They go to Google. And so I do think there's some risk there. And that's why a modern elder is a little different than a traditional elder. A modern elder in the form of like a figurative thinking around the library is somebody who actually understands the past and understands their own, you know, metabolized experience. But they understand the context of how that book may be relevant to someone who's walking into the library and how it's going to be important to them. When an elder mistakes war stories as wisdom, and they just are reciting to people how the world works and how their life was without sort of customizing that wisdom for the individual, that younger person who needs to understand it in the context of the modern world, then you may get someone putting a hand in the face and say, okay, boomer, because there's an element of like, you're just telling me, you know, the way the world worked, not the way the world works. So that's why modern elders have to be curious to look at, you know, how is the world changing, and how it is our wisdom and how it's delivered change with a evolving culture. So I love the library. I love libraries myself, but the bottom line is knowledge is in libraries, wisdom is in people. And ideally it's in that person that you feel that sense, like I just had some wisdom shared with me. And that's where it's valuable, because if I want to find knowledge, all I need is my iPhone.
Well, back in my day. Yeah, that's true. And I'm guilty of that kind of boomerism, mm-hmm. I guess. Very interesting. And really, the book is really fascinating. Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. The next book coming out in January, what title of that one?
It's Learning to Love Midlife, 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age.
Okay. Our guest today, Chip Conley, is the former head of hospitality and strategy at Airbnb and author of Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. He currently runs the Modern Elder Academy. You can learn more about his work at www.modernelderacademy.com. Chip will be the cover story of the May-June issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Chip, thanks so much for joining us at Spirituality and Health Podcast.
Thanks, Rami.
Spirituality and Health Podcast is produced by Ezra Baker Truppiano, and our executive producer is Zach Avery. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating on your podcast app. And if you're not already a subscriber to Spirituality and Health magazine, please become one at spiritualityhealth.com. From everyone at Spirituality and Health magazine, we thank you for your support.